freue mich ganz besonders auf diese Folge von Und hier noch die Quellen, denn ich rede mit einer Wissenschaftlerin, die ich sehr schätze. Ihr Name ist Angelica Ferrara. Sie ist Entwicklungs- und Sozialpsychologin und außerdem Dozentin an der Universität Stanford. Dort ist sie Teil des Clayman Institute for Gender Research, macht also auch geschlechterwissenschaftliche Forschung. Sie ist zudem feministische Autorin. Auf ihr kommendes Buch, was auch auf Deutsch erscheinen wird, werden wir noch zu sprechen kommen. Ich habe sie vor allem deswegen auf ein Interview angefragt, weil ich mit ihr über Mankeeping sprechen möchte. Also unter anderem einer ihrer Forschungsschwerpunkte. Mit Mankeeping ist ein Phänomen gemeint, in dem Frauen deshalb mehr emotionale Arbeit leisten als Männer, weil den Männern in ihrem Umfeld soziale Kontakte, vor allem ja Freundschaften, also auch intime Freundschaften, einfach fehlen. Und das fand ich einen wichtigen Punkt. Deswegen wird es in dem Interview auch um männliche Einsamkeit gehen. Es wird um Männerfreundschaften gehen und eben die Auswirkungen, die das auf die Frauen in dem Umfeld dieser einsamen Männer hat. Das im Sinne von Mankeeping. Das gesamte Interview wird auf Englisch sein. Ich habe mich dazu entschieden, das erstmal unübersetzt zu lassen, weil es einfach ein großer Aufwand ist, das zu übersetzen. Wenn ihr jetzt merkt, so, oh nee, das ist mir irgendwie zu viel und mir genügend Leute entweder eine Mail schreiben auf podcast@ololiebel.com oder eine DM auf Insta oder TikTok, dass ich es bitte übersetzen soll, mache ich das gerne für euch. Aber wenn jetzt nicht wirklich die Nachfrage da ist, dann ist mir das, glaube ich, ein bisschen zu viel, weil ich muss halt alles übersetzen und dann entsprechend neu einsprechen mit einer anderen Sprecherin, die Deutsch kann. Deswegen ist es jetzt. Das Intro ist auf Deutsch, dann kommt das Interview auf Englisch in einer Viertelstunden. Genau, das erstmal zu dieser Zweisprachigkeit jetzt. Ihr könnt das Transkript aber immer auch mitlesen oder nachlesen. Das ist wie also bei jeder Episode von hier noch die Quellen in den Shownotes verlinkt, auch mit den Quellen und mit der Literatur, über die wir sprechen oder die wir heranziehen, um unsere Behauptungen zu belegen. Im Anschluss an das Interview wird noch ein kleiner Debunking-Teil kommen, denn es hat sich im Interview herausgestellt, dass der antifeministische YouTuber und Journalist Matt Walsh die Forschung von Angelica Ferrara aufgegriffen hat, um sich dagegen zu wenden, weil es war ein New York Times-Artikel, der rauskam über Ferraras Forschung und dann hat halt Walsh gesagt, okay, jetzt muss er was dazu machen. Es ist kein Fest, wie man das von antifeministischen Manfluencern so erwarten könnte, aber das habe ich noch so als kleines Goodie noch hinten dran gesetzt. Ja, ich wünsche euch ganz viel Spaß mit dem Interview und wir steigen sofort ein. I want to talk about a lot of subjects with you. Male loneliness, male friendships, the connection of loneliness and politics, about emotional labor, and of course, mankeeping, your research topic that we want to dive into. But I thought we should start with the problem first, which is male loneliness. I think, from male loneliness, you can draw a lot of connections to how men relate to other people, to friends, how much are they in need of emotional work done by women and so on. So I think we should start with the topic of male loneliness. And I have the feeling that the whole discussion around it started in 2021 when a conservative think tank, a survey center on American Life, published two reports on a sharp rise of men in the US without friends. They made the studies and they also did it for young people and said, oh, young men are especially vulnerable to this phenomenon. 28% of them do literally have no close relationships and they called it a male friendship recession.
Right.
Then there was a second turning point, I guess, in 2023, where the YouTuber Shoe on Head published a video called The Male Loneliness Epidemic. And she also quotes the report. And nowadays, we have these two terms of the male friendship recession and the male loneliness epidemic. And I wanted to ask you as a researcher, is this real or is this made up?
There's so much for us to dive into around this.
We have all the time that we need, though.
We could spend an hour on this question. The first thing is that it's complicated for me because some of the statistics that you mentioned are ones I have relied on and really worked hard to search for replications of, which there have been some, right? And I know that it can be suspect, especially to learn of some of the conservative underpinnings of Survey Center on American Life, for example. And I don't want to complicate it further, but the term that I tend to use in my research is neither of those things. One, because male loneliness epidemic, it it's sort of flattening, because loneliness is really only one small dimension of what's going on here in what I consider to be an issue around male social connection and masculinity. So when we hear male loneliness, loneliness is subjectively measured, right? It's a subjective experience of not having the social connection that you desire. But there's so many other components of our social and emotional health that we know men actually often, and we're talking about large Western democracies for the most part, where we have the densest amount of data, things like just how many people do you speak to outside of your house? If you have a problem, how many people can you confide in? How many people could you comfortably say, I love you, to? Where do you have psychological safety in your bonds? There's so many ways, just beyond number of close friendships or number of people in your social network, that we as social scientists put together the complete picture of someone's social health. Loneliness is one dimension. So when I hear loneliness, I think, oh, that feels a little constraining. And then when I hear epidemic, then alarms really go off, because the question is then, who are we talking about? Are we talking about a global epidemic? Are we talking about a certain type of man at which age group? I want to know who we're talking about. So,
I mean, epidemic is just a virus that spreads globally.
Yeah.
And it always poses the question, okay, if we talk about an epidemic, is it that global phenomenon? Is it like a virus that just spreads? And the recession has this temporal dimension that says, oh, it just, you know, recently declined heavily. And then the question is, but is it global? And is it even like a recent thing?
Totally. Okay, so there are two big thoughts that come to mind with this. The recession piece, part of this is actually true. So in that survey that you're referring to, what Daniel Cox, who's a colleague of mine, did was compare it to that 1990 Gallup study where they called people on the phone throughout the United States and they said, how many close friends do you have? That's what they were trying to replicate in that study that you mentioned first, the 2021 one that was conducted during COVID. And so they did see this decline over time, over this 30-year span. And then when we go further and further back in time, that's where we really do see this transformation in male bonds and how men were allowed to relate to each other. And of course, in my book, I argue that men having a ton of social connections was a way of edging women out from public life for hundreds and thousands of years, right? So it's not that we need to go back to this amazing period where men just had emotionally intimate, amazing connections, right? That's way too simplistic of an argument. And then this other piece on global, that's where we could run into trouble as well, because it almost completely doesn't include men in the global south, where connections are framed in ways that are really not necessarily using the same frameworks that we try to look at loneliness and connection through in the global north. So when we speak about global male loneliness epidemic, this feels like a lot of moral panic and a reactionary framework that sort of brings back the focus to be on men and feeling bad for men instead of thinking in the terms of how is patriarchy and misogyny still living today.
But if we stick to this measure of loneliness, there seems to be some point that that people want to know more about the topic. Loneliness seems to be a thing, you know? People are drawn to it. And there is something about the popularity of these terms that is maybe not only connected to moral panic, but really this phenomenon of loneliness. Mm-hmm. You know, just talked about many different ways of that you could also look at, but how is loneliness actually measured?
So loneliness is typically measured by literally asking people of their subjective experience of wanting more social connection. And the myth here is that loneliness is highly gendered. Loneliness is not highly gendered. Loneliness has risen for almost everyone in this sort of conglomerate of countries that we're talking about. As social atomization rises, as living alone rises, as reliance on digital technologies for connection rises, we've seen everybody get more lonely, but it's what men do with their loneliness and how acutely men's loneliness translates to mental health distress that leads to some of the questions I'm asking in my work. So when we ask men and women about their loneliness, we see pretty similar results, actually. But it's those other dimensions of social health that I mentioned to you, such as how psychologically safe do you feel in your bonds? How many people are you talking to? How many people could you go to with a problem? Some of the biggest research firms that are conducting census representative studies on men's social connection show that almost half of men in the US, UK, Canada, and Australia couldn't rely on a single person to talk to you about a problem, right? So you're seeing...
That's serious.
And sometimes that's a 20 percentage point gap from women. It's stunning. It's not a type of, we call it effect size in psychology, that you commonly see. So loneliness is just really one picture of the, one part of the puzzle that just does not get at what this experience really feels like for most people. But loneliness, because so many of us experience it, and it's risen in the last, 25 years in a really profound sense, I think that's why people really latch on to this idea and why it's really powerful.
I mean, loneliness is, maybe loneliness stands for the problem that you just posed. Like, do you have someone to talk to if you have problems? I mean, it could be that you have a lot of acquaintances, that you, hang out with people regularly. I mean, in friendship research, you have this common notion of women with their face-to-face friendships and men with their side-by-side friendships, which means like men doing activities together, hanging out. But that doesn't really mean that you can talk if you really have some emotional troubles going on.
100%. I think that's so astute. And this is always what I try to point out in my work, is that it's not necessarily that men don't have people they can hang out with, right? Mm. Do you feel psychologically alone with the people who you have in your network already? Right.
Which is also a serious question for partnerships. I mean, you can be in a partnership for many years and feel super lonely.
Yes.
Just measuring, do you have people around you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's not as rich of an indicator of really what people's experience is like moving through the world. And then with men, when I work with men after they've just been with their friends for 4 to 6 hours, and then I ask them, okay, how are they doing? How did you feel about that hang? And they're like, honestly, nobody asked me a single thing about, my mom's, diseases she's going through. Nobody asked me about my new apartment, how it's going. Nobody asked me about, being laid off. It's what, I don't know, we talked about for 4 hours, right? So these distinctions between just how many people are in your network versus how do you feel about the quality of the network is something that I think needs to be highlighted more.
If you talk to these men, is it part of your research now or is it a personal experience? I think we all made these experiences, but just for the record.
There are men that I formally interviewed for Men Without Men, my book, and the academic studies that I've been conducting over the last 3 years during my time at the LSE in Stanford, where I've spoken to over 100 men about their social relationships.
Can you talk about these interviews a little bit? I mean, how do you experience the men being confronted also with the questions of it?
Yeah. So one thing that I noticed in recruiting men for this project is that there would be a cohort of men who was really interested and so excited to talk about their relationships. And these tended to be men who had great, great relationships they wanted to talk to me about, right? They wanted to tell me about how much they loved their friends, how much they relied on them, that they were each other's whole worlds. It was, really, really awesome to see and also construct an account of how they got there. Mm. What experience of living in the world as a man led to being able to freely have these sort of bonds. So that was sort of one cohort. But the majority of men who found their way to me found their way through their partners. I would sometimes literally show up to a coffee shop to conduct an interview or log on to a Zoom call. And my first question is usually, so glad you're here. How'd you hear about this project? And so many times men would say, I didn't actually. I don't know why I'm here. My wife put it on my calendar.
Wow.
And I would say, one, that's very difficult because then someone has to consent to participate in a study. So then we'd have to really rewind the tape a bit and be like, so here's who I am. And this is, the kind of questions I'm going to be asking you if you're okay with it. But men's, Terry Real, the psychologist, calls these wife mandated referrals of how men often end up in a psychologist's presence. And that was very, very strong in my work of men saying, I'm here because somebody else told me to be. And then those would be the men who struggled the most with not having friendships.
This is so interesting, this point of we will come back to this point in more detail. But if I remember correctly, there was a study that also connected the health or life expectancy of men to their partnership status, and also said, yeah, maybe it's part of that women care for that the men just have doctor's appointments. That they just call them and say, hey, you have to take care of that, which I think is it's kind of sad. You know, it's your health. What else?
It is sad. And I'm not familiar with that particular study, but the women who responded to this work on mankeeping, which I'm sure we'll talk more about, have actually expanded the term to mean exactly what you're just saying. We were talking the ways that women facilitate men's social networks for them. But what women really wanted to tell us about is how they were also maintaining the social calendar, the medical calendar, all of these sort of cognitive and administrative labors that they were doing on men's behalf. This was a real grievance.
But I want to, you know, jump right into the topic, but let's stick to the loneliness for a couple of minutes, because if we talk about the male loneliness epidemic, it is often referred to as a problem of young men. So the point of age is something I would like to talk about. Do we see patterns of loneliness or of, you know, mental health problems that are more a thing of younger generations, or what can you tell about that? I think depression rates rise also when you get older, but you know, what is it with a young generation?
So this is because there are two cohorts of researchers that are not speaking to each other. One is that the entire field of geriatrics and geriatric health and the medical field, which has studied social isolation and loneliness and its gendered features for years, is not connected to the group of research doing work on young men's social isolation. So they're
Wired.
Yes. And it's also because, you know, even, you know, theoretically, frameworks wise, they're just coming from different camps of, you know, academia and research. And the geriatric work is largely based in the medical establishment. So there are actually two inflection points where we see boys and men struggle with social connection the most. One is in that 18 to 23 group. And then the next is in the post-retirement 60 plus group. So those are two sort of waves in this distribution of when men are most at risk for these phenomena. But there are also transition points in men's lives where they become very vulnerable to these things as well, especially when becoming new fathers, when graduating from school, so leaving a social container where they used to have that social connection built in and surrounding them. These times where men have to reconfigure who they're around are also these vulnerable points.
I mean, there are some more conservative voices saying that if we look at these age groups that are most vulnerable to loneliness or these kind of problems, would say that, you know, you can look at the data and you clearly see that for men, the work is the most important thing. When they work, you know, and they're in their mid-life, so to say, from 25 to 60, whatever, they are happy, they have social connections, this is the way it is. So I think it's connected often to these stereotypical images of, you know, what men want and how men are, and this is why men should work and women should stay at home. Would you respond to these voices?
I think, you know, the tone of just how you express that question is shared, you know, by me. This is a tactic that is used to try to legitimize traditional ways of being a man and telling men that if they want to be well and if they want to be their existences to be worthy on this planet and have connection and be in community and be useful and valuable to other people, they need to work and provide for others, right? This is such a limited view of who men have the capacity to be. But yeah, that feels like
If you see menfluencers all around the world addressing that issue with the most clarity, you know, they see that young men are suffering under their loneliness. Let's stick with the term loneliness. And they address it and they say, I see you and I feel you and you're here with me. and now go to work and get wealthy and then people will come.
That's a grift, right? And yeah. Let's use loneliness as just a stand-in here for that sort of larger composite of social connection and wellness. But it's funny that the people who are most concerned about these topics, me being them, you being one of them, we have this sort of overlap in the Venn diagram where the other people who know the statistics around male isolation really well tend to be these masculinity grifters.
Yeah. Yeah.
They want to leverage that into money and they want to leverage that into a social agenda, right? Andrew Tate on his website has a program called the War Room where he promises men will feel that warm feeling of brotherhood and community and belonging. And he charges men, I believe it's $6,900 US to join the War Room, right? Military campaign recruitment ads. The biggest one in the UK, which has been running and millions and millions of pounds have been spent on it, is the You Belong Here campaign, right? So men's isolation is
It's called You Belong Here campaign.
The You Belong Here campaign. It's on my bus stop down the street in Stoke Newington. This is so commonly used as a frame. So this is part of the larger way of how patriarchy works that I want to highlight in my book and in what I do is that men's isolation is politically and socially expedient for those who are in power because it's very easy to convince a vulnerable population who is looking for connection to be sort of captured by whatever message it is that they're trying to promote.
If we talk about the cure of loneliness, most people wouldn't say, "Oh, go to work and be wealthy." Most people would probably say, "Get some friends."
Yeah.
So I think we should shift the topic to male friendships a little more. Mm. When I tried to do the research on my own for my book about masculinity and emotions, was I surprised? Maybe not. But I was still shocked about the fact that the sociology of friendship is such a small field. I mean, I'm coming more from the sexual sciences where I did a lot of research for my first book on friendship benefits. And there I was stunned by the fact how many people can imagine of having a friend with benefits relationship of already having experience with it, but yep. There is literally no German research on it. Mm-hmm. And even like when the book was published, I think I read every paper on friends benefits out there,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, I'm not happy to say this because science shouldn't be that way. You shouldn't be able to read every paper of a field of research, yeah. Especially if it's about friendship. I mean, friendship, it's the most important relationship in life.
I agree.
How can it be that it remains so under-researched? I mean, you're now a Stanford researcher. You should know your stuff. Why is it the case? I don't get it.
I wish I had the most satisfying response to this because well, for me to understand why other people don't do, you know, certain research, I can tell you about why I do it.
Yeah.
And, but it's shocking how little data we still have on the effects of friendships, on how friendships are cultivated, maintained. We are just beginning to have a body of work showing that friendships maintain not just our mental health, but our physical health because of how they affect the cortisol and stress pathways in the body and their relationship to inflammation. There is so much that we could do in the field, and it's growing. I think it's particularly growing in the U.S. because of, you know, these awareness campaigns around, you know, the health risks of just being isolated. The U.S. Surgeon General making this a really big priority. There being a minister of loneliness at some point in the United Kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
So I wish I had something more satisfying for you other than just sharing your frustration massively and wishing there were more for us. But particularly within men's friendships, I'm working with what I've got. I'm doing what I can with what I have. But there's so many low-hanging fruits, basic questions that we don't have the answers to.
For example,
what are the ways that most men have made their friendships?
Mm. Because I wanted to talk about the differences between male friendship and female friendships, if you want to work with these broad categories.
Yeah.
But I mean, just from an everyday life experience, we all know that there is a difference coming, you know, from how your gender is expressed, how you're allowed to feel, how you're allowed to talk, what do you think is important stuff. There's an obvious difference in how they relate. And I think especially in cross-gender relationships or cross-gender friendships, these differences become conflicts or sources of conflicts.
They do. This is a tough one for me because I spend a lot of my career telling people about the ways that there are not differences and that the ways you see constructed, right? That both and all genders are enacting norms and frameworks that we've been taught. For example, I grew up on television shows like Sex and the City, normalized, legitimized four women sitting around a table, diving deep into relationships and analyzing them, analyzing a text message from a guy, talking about our triumphs and our fears and our little worries and daily hassles. Whereas what men were generally raised with is no example of male relating outside of a quest, a conquest, a adventure, doing something active and any sort of emotional connection that comes out of that as just being a byproduct. That's not even the focus. That men talk about information, that they don't talk about the substance of their inner world. This is what we've been fed, right? So when that's our diet in terms of what we've been exposed to, it's not a surprise that our relationships can look so, so different. Yet what I'm always trying to push on this is that many men are ready for and want friendships that look more like the types of bonds that women have been raised to maintain.
Yeah, and if you ask about the reasons why is it the case, you often hear this more conservative argument. Yeah, it's because of evolutionary biology, because, you know, men were hunting and women caregivers, you know, it's close to the children, so they have to expect their emotional needs and stuff. And on the first sight, you might think, oh yeah, that's intuitively correct or so. But if you have a second look, I mean, not even looking at the signs, all know it's out there, but not even looking at the signs, I think, like, what does it even mean that you don't need emotions when you're hunting? Because if you're hunting, of course you have to plan some stuff, but most of the time, you just walk around some forests and then suddenly something appears and you don't have to think, you have to feel, you have to connect, you have to, get a grip of where are the others.
Must be attuned to the attention.
Yeah. So it's pretty emotional. And if I think about, caregivers' work,
I love that.
I do my dishes, have no emotions at all. I'm bored, maybe. But most of the care work that you have to do at home is repetitive, extremely organizational work with no emotions involved at all. So I don't get this.
But yet that type of work has been framed exclusively as of loving care, of being sort of love's laborer. And these other things that men have been taught to do are supposed to apparently have nothing to do with being attuned to the world. Yes, it's intuitively nonsense. It's also historically nonsense, right? I am looking through right now, the books that are surrounding me are men's letters to their friends in the 16, 17, 18, and 1900s, how men spoke to each other about their anxieties, about their, did this woman bring me up? Could you please pass along this message? I believe there was a stolen glance the other day. Men clearly have an expansive emotional world and talked about it at length with one another and how they felt about each other, saying that their souls were interwoven. These things are so common in the historical record. So if you were to put an evolutionary argument forward, what that would require would be that men then had a rapid evolution, basically after the Industrial Revolution. And that's not how evolution works, right? That all of a sudden men then what became their nature, which was historically not the case, right? It's not, the math just really doesn't work here. And it also doesn't work when we look at men who have close bonds today, of which there are many, right? There are so many. And the friendships of boys and adolescents, right? Which clearly show males' capacity for sensitivity, care, and the, giggly, gossipy, excited friendships that we've been taught to associate with women.
I mean, you told me about the man that you interviewed. And the card was super bubbly about it and happy about it, talking about your best friend. What? I mean, talking about the best friend is such a refreshing experience. I'm so in love with my friends.
Oh, like, Same.
Really?
Same. I texted my best friend. I was eating a piece of toast earlier, and I texted her, like, isn't toast great? Like, that was the text. Nothing else. I'm just like, don't you, you know, isn't that just, like, great that it exists? Like, and nothing else. Like, we just tell each other absolutely everything, stream of consciousness, from the stupidest things to the biggest things. And many men in my research have similar relationships, or, you know, some of the best friends that I cover in a piece I wrote for Eon magazine, Basil and Alex call each other, hello, you beautiful cinnamon roll. Hello, little kumquat, whatever it is. They start every phone call this way, you know, coming up with new endearments. These relationships are all around us. It's just that the narrative we have around what's visible and that there's a significant cohort of men who struggle has become the dominant paradigm.
But at the same time, those friendships are not only a private thing. If I see how I relate to my best male friend, we are pretty physical, like not in a sexual way, just, you know, hugging a lot, sitting on each other's laps, you know, giving kisses on cheeks and stuff, just because we like each other. And we do this since we know each other, so it has never been an issue, which is rare. But if I look at how people react to our friendship, it's crazy. Because on the one hand, you know, we are usually are taken for a gay couple.
Mm-hmm.
Which is fine. I mean, I don't care. I'm not hetero at all. But, you know, if people then experience, we are just friends,
mm-hmm.
they kind of say, oh, that's so beautiful. Oh my God, I never thought. And then I say, like, yeah, thank you. But it's always this extra attention in the good and in the bad way, you know, getting the homophobic stuff on the one hand, and also the hyper positive longing and projection of how male friendships could be. If I mean, I'm not a shy person and pretty extrovert, and he's an actor, so we're both, you know, cool with that. But if you're a shy person or introvert, it's just a lot. There are many norms surrounding male friendships also, which is another thing that is, I think, important. It's not just, you know, how men are raised, but how people look at these relationships. And this is not absolutely independent of gender, but this is more of a bigger picture, how these friendships are perceived.
Right. And the polarities that you're talking about to how far we have to go, that it's either just seeing two men interact that way who are friends is so foreign that it's incomprehensible. It just doesn't fit into a legible framework for
at least in Western societies.
In society. Yeah. And then on the other side of that is, oh, that's so beautiful. That's so special. Almost congratulating you, right?
Yeah.
For going against this norm as if this should be something that we fawn over, right? Sort of similar to when men, you know, wear a baby on their...
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, we should give them an award for doing something that we see women do surrounding us all the time that we don't even notice, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I really think that this topic, I mean, that's why it's so big for me, is that it really sits at the core of everything, because friendships are how we learn those skills of reciprocity, empathy, perspective taking, conflict management, touch, how to navigate touch, how much touch, how do I know when someone doesn't want touch anymore or needs touch? These are things we learn in friendships. So if we're not learning those and flexing those skills, this is a problem.
Before I go to another question, when you talked about the man holding a baby, I stumbled over a video which is called the title is called "Nap Time Begins with Cute Cuddles." It's 17 seconds, and it was watched by 220 million people. And it's just a man, like beginning of his 30s, I don't know, mid 30s, with his young daughter in his arms, and he's holding a nap, and she's cuddling next to him, and then falling asleep. 17 seconds, 220 million people who've watched this video. I tried to search a similar video. Like, I went to YouTube, I typed in nap time cuddle mom, just to see what pops up. And, you know, the videos with the most views were just soft porn ASMR videos with a mommy kink, with titles like Napping on Mommy's Chest, mm-hmm. Soft Rain, Head Pads. And, you know, there's a subtitle that says, You did so wonderful today, my little boy. And the video is lasting for 3 hours. And I was like, yeah.
You know, always, I have a question for you around it, because I'm of two minds when I see things like this.
Yeah.
In one, I have a sort of exasperation of, oh, yes, okay, we're obsessing and kinking out on a man doing something that women around the world are doing every yeah. day. And it's so noteworthy to us because of its rarity and how absolutely intensely we desire it from men, right? We are so starved for their tenderness that any of these flashpoints of their tenderness become cultural flashpoints.
Yeah.
In one point, there's the exasperation. And on the other side of me, I'm like, well, actually, that is revolutionary. Actually, it is important that images and videos of men inhabiting those ways of being should be seen on such a platform. So where do you navigate that sort of exasperation eye roll, but also the, wow, this is really important?
Yeah. I will never really understand why it is so difficult for men to not be able to have female role models.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many people talking about, we need, you know, male role models showing this and that it's fine. And I always was wondering, why is that the case? I thought role models are people who do stuff in the world, mm-hmm. and I am admiring them for their actions and mm-hmm. not necessarily for the identity. I mean, I get it. Sometimes the identity is connected to it. If there is racial segregation and you're a black person and you do not make seat for a white person and say, I will stay here, that is a different point. But still, it's about the action that the person is doing and not necessarily about the identity. And, even, you know, if I see people like Rosa Parks or so, they can be a role model, even though I'm a white man.
Mm-hmm.
So what? Point. Why do we need role models that fit our identity?
Oh, this one is actually a tough one for me, because I completely see that perspective as super valid. And I have said it many times. And I have a video I'll have to send you after this. It's one of my favorites. It's a news report on the boys must be about 8 years old. They're in a school and they're all describing their role model. And it's the janitor of their school who is a woman.
Really?
And no one does it like her.
She I'm back in the show notes.
It's beautiful. And it proves your point so
compelling. But how old are
they're about 8 or 9.
Yeah, and that's, I think, an important point, because children do not show these differences in such a stark manner. If we talk about gender differences, often, you know, psychoanalytic theory comes up, and then we talk about babies and, you know, the early month and stuff, and how they relate to mothers and fathers and the conflicts arising from, you know, separating yourself from your dad, identifying yourself with a mother or loving your mother or whatever. But the harshest gender differences come up in adolescence, and I don't see why these teenage years are so out of focus.
There's a lot we could focus on there with what the social brain is becoming more aware of at that point in development. But I'm still stuck on the point of the role model piece, because I do notice when I get to work with boys in schools, how they respond when, remember, sometimes 93 to 98% of their teachers are women. There's nothing wrong with this. And the people they are looking up to and modeling themselves around do happen to be adult women. Who are their pediatricians? Who are the social workers? They tend to, for the most part, overwhelmingly be women. And so when boys do not see people who look like them, and I do think this argument was made for many years about girls and women, right? If we do not see in positions of leadership or importance in society people who look like us, we do take account of that. And when boys light up when their school nurse is a man, it's made me experientially, theoretically, intellectually, I totally see your point. But when I'm in the room with boys and I see how they respond to seeing men in these roles, my opinion has sort of been changed on this, where I'm saying I think it is important for them to have a diverse range of models and metaphors to see about how one can be a boy in the world.
Yeah, but as long as these role models are not as public as we would wish them to be.
Yeah.
We're still struggling with men being men and doing the work that they do and or not doing the work that they do. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to focus on the consequences that these stereotypes, these role models, the still prevalent ones, have for people around men who are not able to cope with their emotions. So I'd like to jump to the topic of emotional labor and man keeping. Before we dive into the discussion more deeply, I would kindly ask you to separate some terms for us and our audience, because if we look around the feminist social media discourse, terms like mental load, emotional labor, sometimes for the more academic ones, emotion work, and man keeping are all used together. How would you differentiate emotional labor, mental load, and man keeping? And maybe then we can talk about the question whether there's difference between emotional labor and emotion work. We don't have this difference in German because Arbeit is both work and labor. But yeah, I'd be interested in your perspective on that.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to separate them, especially because emotional labor actually comes out of a very specific study and research paradigm from the Professor Arlie Hochschild. She really framed this idea of the emotion that one has to produce in a paid work setting for one's work to be compensated in the way it must be carried out for that particular job. So, for example, what is the correct term? A flight attendant, or was sometimes called air hostess. Her research was heavily focused on their experience of emotional labor, of the kindness, of the smiling, of the gentleness, of the feminine archetype that had to be embodied to do that job successfully and to be liked by one's customers.
In so, that sense, hostess is maybe the more correct term. It's not the correct, like politically correct one, but mm-hmm. addressing the labor that they had to do or the image that they had to represent.
Yes.
The harmless, you know, friendly woman always passing mm-hmm. stuff, you know.
100%. And this term really came from conceptualizations of paid labor.
Yeah. Right?
The emotions that one has to enact to do paid labor in a way that is gendered correctly. The mental load seems to, from my understanding, come mostly out of feminist discourse online around this sort of juggling in working and long-term memory around the people in our lives that we have to keep happy and maintain harmony with. Like you mentioned earlier, I need to maintain his social calendar, his medical calendar. I need to pack the children's lunches. I need to these sorts of mental real estate that gets taken up is how I usually see mental load referred to. And then emotion work is the closest to my research, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is the effort that is put in to achieving a sort of emotional result in one's interpersonal life. And in the context of man-keeping, we're highlighting the work that women do to shore up or compensate for the ways that men do not have as rich of social networks where they can talk about their problems and rely on a diverse range of people. So this is the work that women do to say, hey, you haven't hung out with your friends in a while. Maybe you should call David, or you should join my friends tonight. You haven't left the house in a while, or all these sorts of things that we see women do. Or because so many men have not had the opportunity to flex those social emotional capacities, like we talked about, listening, perspective taking, empathy, conflict resolution, touch norms, touch intelligence, these things, it's women's teaching men of these skills, having to compensate for the fact they do not have these skills. So that we see as emotionally effortful work, and it maps on to those more academic frameworks that you're talking about in the emotion work literature.
Okay, so to sum that up, or to connect it once again for me and the audience, so the mental load is the cognitive and emotional
burden
that mm-hmm. women bear because they have to do all the organizational and also emotional stuff that are going around if you do care work.
Yes.
And part of that is the emotional labor. Is it now emotional labor? Is it only in the sense of labor, like doing paid work?
I separate labor in terms of
pain. And I want to stick with your terminology here. So and part of this mental load is coming from emotion work, because, you know, they have to care for the people around them. And if they especially care for men and for the lack of their emotional skills, then it turns into men keeping. Am I right about that? So like breaking it down a little?
I want to also mention, too, that part of the mental load is being attuned to many people's inner worlds at once.
Yeah. So,
So I am attuned to making sure that your inner world is fully supported, because you don't have as many connections to support that as I might. So I need to be extra attuned to you, right? Mm-hmm. This is what our research really tries to highlight when we speak to women about their experience. That mental load is not just all the things that I need to do, but it's I need to be vigilant of your state so that I can keep you happy, which will then will keep us happy, then we'll keep our family happy, this sort of dynamic.
And that requires a lot of emotional skills. That are, of course, learned and repeated and trained and reflected.
Yes, that is social reproduction, right? This also, the think about how many modalities are activated in the vigilance for the other state, right? So that's all these capacities related to attunement. Mm-hmm. Then the behaviors of modifying or taking action to bring someone into the state of harmony or peace or emotional regulation that you might want. Then all the work of maintaining and facilitating connections for that person. This sounds like a lot here, but this is actually a really common experience that women talked about when they heard man-keeping. And I think why it's been spread so far and translated into so many languages is because so many women looked at that and they said, yeah, that's me every day.
Do you know when people came up with the term man-keeping?
I came up with it.
Are you? What?
Yeah.
No, you came up with the term man-keeping.
Well, I coined it. but what I didn't coin was kin-keeping, which is the term that my research came from. So kin-keeping is all of the work that women put in to maintain harmony within their family life, particularly the nuclear heterosexual heteronormative family. So these are things like, okay, somebody got upset at dinner. I need to follow up with them after. Or, oh, it's Teacher Appreciation Day. I don't know if they have that in Germany. I need to send my child with a flower to school, or, you know, whatever it is. Oh, we went on a holiday. We should really take a picture because we didn't take any pictures on this whole holiday. These sort of noticing and taking actions to create good feeling in the family. This has been called kinkeeping. So my research is in response to the data that we have showing that men are lacking social connection at a higher level than women, and really looking at how this manifests in cross-gender bonds, particularly women's labor on behalf of men. So that's really the niche that I honed into with man-keeping. But yeah, it comes from me and my research assistant, Dylan Vergara.
I really try to do a lot of science communication, which is also part of highlighting the process of doing the science. And I wonder of how do you study something as hidden and as diffuse as man-keeping? I remember studies that show that heterosexual women report less emotional labor compared to homosexual women and other men, and conservative men report more emotional labor done by their partners than liberal men.
Interesting.
And I thought, like, I first read them and I was like, why is it the case? And then I thought, ah, yeah, for sure. Because conservative men are so not used to do emotional labor that if they do it, they absolutely overreport it. And for heterosexual women, it's such a common experience that they probably underreport it.
Yes.
Which makes the studies more comprehensible. Yeah. And as you have written in your paper, we have no studies measuring the actual suffering or costs for women.
Right.
And then I really thought, how can that be again? And then the second question or follow up, how do you measure it if people are subjectively, they are not even aware of it? I mean, if you're deep into feminist discourse and discussing it with your friends all the time, then you might get a hint of what you're actually doing. But if you don't, you don't know.
this is a really big problem. And even those points that you just made around which group would over or underestimate their labor is a really astute one. In terms of measuring man keeping, what I'm always trying to do, and the current scale or measure, as we call it in psychology, to measure man keeping, we are looking at behaviors, right? Mm-hmm. We're not looking at how you feel about the behaviors, although some of our questions get a little closer to that. But really these questions of what did you in the last week, right? In the last month, what did you do to facilitate your husband's social calendar, right? So number of times you did X, number of times you did Y. These sort of behavioral measures are really important for actually looking at what are people doing? How often are they having conversations about the other person's emotional state? Tell me about the last week of your life. So these things help us get a little bit closer instead of, do you do a lot of emotional labor in your relationship? You know,
yeah.
What's a lot? That depends on all sorts of things like your identity and how you've been raised to move through the world.
It's pretty similar to what we talked about when it comes to loneliness. It's not, you know, are you lonely? Yes, no, maybe. It's more like, do you know someone to call to if you have problems? It's a similar thing, which
yeah.
It points to actual behaviors and not attitudes or subjective states.
Exactly. So that's why a person with 10 friends might answer the question of, do you feel lonely, the same as a person with 2 friends, right?
Yeah.
It's only about the individual experience of it, such as the question of, do you do a lot of emotional labor? This, what counts as a lot, is going to completely change.
When you came up with the term man-keeping and you did your research, I mean, you're in the bubble of doing academia.
Mm-hmm.
But you recently published an article, I think it was the New York Times, wasn't it?
The New York Times covered my research. The reporter Catherine Pearson did a feature on man-keeping, but I did not write it myself.
Okay, but I think it blew up, didn't it?
It did.
How was the response?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked about this. I haven't really gotten to talk about that very much. The response came with a lot of people writing in to say this was their experience, but also a lot of misogynistic abuse and men from all corners of the manosphere. Matt Walsh, the conservative podcaster, has made a video about man-keeping. I have not watched it, but I do know that it exists. It's been on Fox News. It's been in many areas where I never thought the term would ever be spoken. So it's come with a surprising amount of blowback, but also a huge sense of affirmation and resonance from especially women and men who say, yeah, this used to be me, or it is me, and I don't want it to be anymore.
I think I should do a debunking on the Matt Walsh video. We could do it after the interview. I mean, I can watch it and get back to you with some questions, and then I can put it in the part where I talk by myself.
I would love it. I'm pretty much, you know, I try not to fill my mental or energetic space with people like that. So that's why I haven't watched it. And that's why I have a lot of my friends, you know, summarize negative comments for me and things like that, because I just don't have the time or sort of space for it.
And the book that is coming up, if you are allowed to talk about it,
yeah.
Will it cover this topic in more detail? Or is it a broader thing? I mean, the title, can I say what the title is?
Yeah, thank you.
Men Without Men will be the title of the book. Für alle meine deutschen Hörer, es wird auch auf Deutsch veröffentlicht bei Hansa Blau. Also, what is the translation of the German title? Do you know it?
I don't know.
Yeah, let's see. Maybe it's Männer ohne Männer. Wir werden sehen. So, yeah, ihr könnt es auch in Deutsch kaufen. Kommt wahrscheinlich irgendwann 2026. We'll see about that. So, yeah. How did you come up with a book? Are there main things you want to tell us about it? Why should we read it? And how is it connected to what we talked about?
Thank you so much for just giving me the opportunity to talk about it. So, funny enough, man-keeping came out of my research for the book in a very unsuspecting way. Most people think this comes from listening to tons of women about their experience of emotional labor. It actually came with me beginning to understand the phenomenon of men's lack of social connection and my interviews with men across the global north, US, UK, Western Europe, Canada, Australia, where men talked to me about not having anyone they could rely on for emotional connection beyond their girlfriend, wife, or female friend.
Just to understand, so you started your interviews because you were interested in male friendships.
Yes.
And then you came to the term of men, or the phenomenon of man keeping.
It was men who put us off that this was happening.
Interesting.
And that's why I started to interview women, was because men essentially made it clear to myself and my research assistant at the time that they were overly relying on women in ways that were not reciprocated. But the conceptualization for my book is really understanding how male relationships became fractured and how ideas around masculinity really diminish not only men's relationship, but their entire personhood in terms of mental and physical health, how this happened, and also what are the exceptions, what are the extraordinary communities that show us that this can look so different. So I spend time working in monastic communities with men who live in brotherhoods. I spent time on a ranch in Colorado with a group that does men's retreats to teach men social and emotional skills by working with horses. I got to work with boys as young as 4, men as old as 95, speaking about their experience of finding connection. And so I'm looking for those places where there are exceptions to these stories. And how do we create that more at scale? So I'm really trying to look for solutions in this book. And there's also just a lot of heartwarming stories about male best friends that are really, really beautiful. But it's a deeper exploration of this entire topic and the context that surrounds it, and man-keeping, or women's burden as a result of male social disconnection, is only one part of the book, really, and not its main focus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. It's such a beautiful phenomenon. If you're doing research and you're focused on a topic and suddenly something else appears in between and it becomes another focal point of how you can develop the stuff that you write down in your book.
Research always needs to be about discovery, because often we do research, we write something, we write what we already know, and we just want it to be out there, versus I actually have questions that I don't know the answer to, right? If men have the capacity for social connection, but yet they are not having those needs met with their social connection, where are they having it met? So this really like...
Do you mean as a projection, or as a how they transfer their needs to other... I didn't get it, I think.
We didn't know the answer to either of those things at the moment.
Oh, yeah.
Right? When this research was being conducted. Mm-hmm. So having those questions and hypotheses, and not necessarily just saying, oh, we want to go in and really just show how men are emotionally stunted and patriarchy hurts them. That's not the frame that we go in with, because it's not from the part of curiosity. But I think what going in with so much openness allowed us to do was to really listen a bit closer and say, okay, what are men telling us about how they are having their needs met? And actually, what does that mean for heterosexuality and relationships?
Yeah, because if I remember the popular literature on masculinity, you know, men writing about their own masculinity, critically reflecting upon it and stuff, it's rarely the case that they see that they get into how they actually do it, but always how it is not possible, how, you know, the gender role is prohibiting them of doing this or that. But you came up with the term man keeping because men were telling you how they try to manage that their emotional needs cannot be met by themselves or through themselves.
And there were all of these stereotypes and scientific untruths out there, such as the friendship researcher Robin Dunbar, who is considered to be the godfather of friendship research, is quoted in The Guardian saying men don't really do deep discussion. This is an evolutionary psychologist.
Ah, okay, evolutionary psychologist. I got that.
The most controversial part of my field is evolutionary psychology in terms of, you know, the different parts of psychology. That one's the most, I think, empirically suspect. But what was important to me to mention about that was that there were all of these ideas out there about how men are apparently just lacking capacity for this. But yet they were saying in my research their secrets, their fears, their insecurities, all the things they notice around them, their anxiety. So the way that men were appearing in front of my eyes did not match the science stereotypes that were out there in society. So it was really the low-hanging fruit of just saying, actually, men do want to talk about, you know, interior design and hair removal and all sorts of things. Who even knows, right? An interaction that went poorly where they were feeling clumsy. We act like men just completely do not have the capacity for these things that all of us think about because we're human. And so my research was really just making that clear, is that men were talking about these things and they were talking about it with women.
Yeah. I mean, I have a very special relationship to evolutionary biology or evolutionary psychology even more. If I see, okay, Jordan B. Peterson is not, you know, as regarded academically as other people, but David Buss and, you know, other folks do have strange opinions on gender.
Yeah.
And is there no way to rescue evolutionary biology? I mean, if I think, like, this is now a theory that I made up, in the sense of that if we talk about emotions and feelings and their evolutionary use, or, you know, what they were meant to do, it's probably sorting, prioritizing, anchoring the different experiences that we made in the world. You know, what is valuable to us makes us emotional. Mm. Why? Because it's important for us to survive. Mm. We need to be emotional about the things that, you know, can harm us or that can support us in our life. And as social animals, that we are as humans, more social than probably any species out there, of course, social ties are absolutely vital for our well-being and our survival, especially when it comes to child rearing, which, like, 18 years, considering how low the life expectancy was and stuff. So in order to understand the social fabrics that surround us and that support us, we need emotions. Emotions anchor us in these social relationships and they make us understand the social relationships. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, if I know how pride feels, just an example, I can see it in other people.
Mm-hmm.
So I need to feed in order to be a human being full of empathy.
Yeah.
And that is absolutely crucial for everyone to actually, you know, be part of society, which is a totally evolutionary argument, absolutely based on, you know, what is important for survival, but it's just not gendered. Feelings are there for everyone, necessarily.
They are. And the most rigorous studies that, you know, meta-analytic studies looking at gender differences say exactly what you said, actually, that we are predisposed biologically to feel, to have narrative, to be attuned to the social world. It helps all of us. And we come into this world with a fundamental motivation to form close relationships. And as a psychologist who studied human development, what people in my field will tell you, obviously including me, is that developmental milestones are not just things like, can your baby turn over? Does your four-year-old walk in a straight line? They are, do they notice the states of others? Like you said, by feeling pride in myself, I can recognize it out in the world. That's called an emotional appraisal, right?
Mm-hmm.
If I appraise an emotion and feel it within myself, I can recognize it within my own body and mind, then I'm able to see the world with that much more color and differentiation and navigate my relationships with it. So developing as a person is not just, does the person grow up to be able to, you know, participate in society and hold a job?
Yeah.
But can they read the facial cues of others? Can they sense when there's an underlying tension in the air in a social...
Which is, by the way, super important for doing your job good. I mean, independent of, you know, emotion work that we talked about, but really, you know.
Yes, exactly, right? All these things that we consider to be soft skills, right? And that, you know, silly differentiation. So yes, I mean, all of these things are... core to what we mean by social and emotional development, or literally just human development, is the development of emotional competency.
So if you develop a sensitivity towards your emotions, which is, or sensibility, oh, not sure, whatever.
And sensitivity.
Yeah, sensitivity. Mm-hmm. and you feel more complex emotions or you understand complex emotions more, you're also able to understand complex social interactions better because they are motivated by sometimes very complex emotional states.
Yes.
So
yes.
It's just helpful.
And it's not then a far-fetched argument to say that when boys begin to lose their friendship around age 14, 15, and 16, as they approach the initiation into manhood and the social brain becomes more and more aware of what I have to do to have status as a boy or a man, when boys begin to not practice those same skills that you just mentioned, the emotional appraisal, I've been, you know, droning on here about listening skills, perspective taking, empathy. If you don't use these things, they're like other muscles. We tend to lose them, right? We become clumsy about them and we can actually become less attuned to the world, even though we are biologically predisposed to develop those skills and we tend to as children. So if men do not practice them, it leaves this skill differential between men and women where women continue to go on into adulthood, flexing those skills, navigating conflicts and navigating these sort of intricacies and intangible emotional dynamics of a room. And when men are told that, like, actually that's women's thing and you're not, you know, that's not your bag, this is when we run into a really big problem. And this skill differential is this term I've been increasingly using to try to describe what I mean when we encourage men not to flex the skills that they inherently have as human beings.
I also stumbled upon this term of normative male alexithymia.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think you have heard it. For the audience, alexithymia is, I think, from Greek, and it means the inability to speak from your heart, like literally translating now the term. And so we talked about this subject so often that even like in science, we have a very clear term for it, the normative male alexithymia, which I think is, telling.
So that particular difficulty is around identifying and describing emotions, right?
Yeah.
Like speaking from the heart. So can I recognize
their own emotion? Yeah.
In my body, in my mind, this is what anger feels like. This is what shame feels like. This is what embarrassment is like. And that's how it's different from shame or guilt or other states. And then can I use my words, right? Then can it become a linguistic function to describe what I'm feeling in others? Which, of course, this can also relate to appraising emotions in others, not just the self.
So in your interviews where you talked about feelings, have you seen this phenomenon of men not being really able to feel, but not able to articulate their feelings? It's often also, it's probably almost a meme. If you ask men how they are, you usually get five terms like good, bad, hungry, horny, tired, angry, and that's it.
You know, I go back to those sort of ideas of different cohorts of men that typically encountered my research. So for so many men, that's a stereotype, right? They have an incredible treasure trove of language to describe their experiences and would want to talk about that. And for that to be considered not a threat to their masculinity in any way, that they do have these just capacities to describe their experience. But then there would be men who would sit across from me often who would say, I want to tell you how I feel, but I just can't. And my girlfriend could if she was here, but I just don't have the ability to do it. And that's why, you know, I'm trying to go to therapy or I'm just going to give up altogether. And those men were often the men who were taught to perform the most stringent forms of masculinity that alienated them from their inner capacity for relational intelligence.
And then there are the men who talk so much about their own feelings, like literally all the time, that you feel like an emotional trash bag, you know, where they are very aware of how they feel and they can put into words super nicely, but they just cannot listen.
That might be a description of someone who has a heightened awareness of their internal state, but is completely lacking attunement to be able, we call that theory of mind in psychology, to perceive of other people's minds and experiences. So they become alienated from not the self, but the other, which I would argue is sort of an alienation from self, but that's a different conversation. The ability to even sense that there's not a reciprocity in an interaction is a difficulty, is a struggle with emotional competence.
Yeah, you already mentioned the term attunement, or, you know, getting in tune with someone emotionally in order to listen to them, to care for them, to understand them, to, you know, protect their desires, feelings, thoughts, and so on. Do we have a German term for attunement? Not quite in the way that it is in English, because the tune, you know, as the sound waves becoming a harmony, you know, vibing in a way.
Right, being able to sense when a tune is high, when it's low, when it's discordant, when it's harmonizing.
And when we talked about the emotional labor, I think you mentioned this state of attunement first. So it seems to be also a pretty like female-coded thing, that attunement comes first, not sensing your own emotions first, then regulating it, and then attuning. But first attuning, regulating everything, and later on, caring for your own emotions. So would you say it's an... So we talked about, you know, men keeping, why men need it, what do they do? But what is the effect on women if they do the men keeping all the time? I mean, you interviewed women, you said.
I can tell you what they tell us.
Which
aligns with how we hypothesized it in the original research. The experience is often one of burden and burnout, of this sense of worry also, that if the woman is not able to be there for the man, that he will have no one. And if something were to happen to her, if she were just not to be available, who would he talk to? This sort of sense of an underlying back burner worry about...
But wait, these are their, the women's thoughts or the men's worries?
The women's thoughts.
Oh, wow. Okay. I was just listening to you and I was confused in the middle of the sentence. I was like, wait, what is she talking about? And that is telling.
This is a women's experience. And there's also a lot of anger. I did not know, and this was not the dream of heterosexual romance that I was fed and that I believed I was signing up for. It was a surprise to many women that, you know, 20 years into their marriage, they would become the full emotional manager of the man's inner life, and that he would not have other people to talk to about what's going on with his inner world. So there was disappointment, frustration, anger, resentment, and just a sense of being tired.
And where can you formulate that feelings or that reactions in your relationship? I think it's quite tough to tell your partner, hey, I love to care for you, but it makes me extremely angry.
It was very hard, and these were sort of the limitations of my remit as the type of psychologist who does research and does not go into these interviews from a therapeutic perspective, because sometimes women would ask, what do I do? And that becomes a different conversation, right?
How do you respond to that? If
I'm there to document the phenomenon and express it with the highest degree of fidelity to what they're telling me, and qualitatively analyze that. But we would often just sit there in the room sort of being at a loss of saying, how do you want to bring this up? And women would say, well, I think we could go to couples therapy, but I know I'm going to be the one finding the couples therapist. I'm going to be the one finding the time on his calendar. And that just makes me more and more angry. So we would sometimes get to really dark places in the interviews where I would really ask a woman who would describe this as a massive burden and saying, why do you stay? And we would be at a loss of there would be this sense of, I'm not sure, but I want things to be better. And my hope, though, with this work is that more and more people, the seed is planted of, is this the way it has to be? Because if you look at the comments on the Daily Mail describing mankeeping, there's going to be tons of women who are saying, this is what it means to be a woman. This is part and parcel of what it means to be a wife. And the whole thing of feminism is just saying, is the way things are the way things have to be, right? Is there another way to do this? And that's what I hope seeing this term take off across the internet has done for people, even if you're not politically or, gender conscious, that you at least say, okay, I'm doing this work and there's now this word for it. Can I think a little bit deeper about, is that the way I want my relationships to be? That's the hope, is that it causes a little bit of interrogation.
And I think it's a beautiful end of the interview. It's just in German I would say zugewandt. I have no idea what this is in English, but anyway, it's a very positive term. Thank you very much for being on my podcast. It was a very delightful interview and very insightful. Thank you
so much for having me. It means a lot. And just thank you for doing the work that you do.
Ja, wie im Interview mit Ferrara angekündigt, folgt jetzt noch ein kleines Debunking des antifeministischen YouTubers oder Journalisten, Podcasters Matt Walsh, der in Reaktion auf den New York Times Artikel über Ferraras Forschung eben ein Video veröffentlicht hat. Kurz zu Matt Walsh, es ist halt ein konservativer Journalist, hat auf YouTube 3,3 Millionen AbonnentInnen und mir ist er das erste Mal aufgefallen, also ich kannte so ihn so ein bisschen aus so einer Man-Influencer-Ecke natürlich, aber so richtig, tiefer habe ich seine Inhalte erst gesehen, als ich 2022 seine extrem cringige Doku What is a Woman mir angeschaut habe, was ich natürlich versucht, so neutral und objektiv wie möglich mit dem Thema Transgeschlechtlichkeit auseinanderzusetzen. Aber bei solchen Typen wie Matt Walsh folgt dann eigentlich nur reine Propaganda. Das war jetzt auch nicht ganz verwunderlich. Auf jeden Fall hat er ein Video gemacht und damit ihr es nicht angucken müsst, dachte ich, fasse ich mal zusammen, was er da ungefähr drin sagt. Seine Kernthese ist auch gleich am Anfang gesetzt, warum er Mankeeping für Quatsch hält, denn...
So mankeeping is when a wife is expected to, be a wife.
Ja, genau. Mankeeping heißt einfach nur, eine Frau ist eine gute Frau. Wenn man sich jetzt fragt, ja... Okay, was verstehst du denn jetzt genauer unter Mankeeping? Also was macht denn diese Frau zu einer guten Frau? Dann kommt er auch zu einer Definition. Diese Definition, die er dann aber gibt, hat er, was er auch selber sagt, von Google. Und ich denke mir so, hä? Du kannst doch einfach in die Forschung von Ferrara gucken, die diesen Begriff offensichtlich erfunden hat. Also das ist ja weithin verfügbar. Aber nein, er gibt dann bei Google Mankeeping ein und dann bekommst du ja von der KI so eine automatische Zusammenfassung. Und auf dieser KI-Definition von Mankeeping basiert er eben seine weiteren Ausführungen. Diese Definition von Google besagt aber, dass Frauen eben mehr emotionale Arbeit als Männer leisten und das sei unbezahlte Care-Arbeit und das eben ist das Problem, was Mankeeping aufwirft. Aber was Ferrara ja sagt, oder was sie nicht sagt, ist, dass jede emotionale Fürsorge unbezahlte Care-Arbeit ist und sie sagt auch nicht, jede unbezahlte Care-Arbeit ist Mankeeping, sondern was Angelica Ferrara sagt, was ja auch in dem Interview klar wurde, es gibt einen Bedarf an Sozialität, also an sozialem Miteinander, der über lange Zeiten von Freundschaften, die Männer untereinander haben, gedeckt worden ist. Aber der in einer Zeit, wo die emotionale Verkümmerung von vielen heterosexuellen Männern um sich greift und wo sie zunehmend damit zu kämpfen haben, keine intimen Beziehungen zu führen, vor allem auch nicht zu anderen Männern, eben von wem aufgefangen werden muss? Von den Frauen in ihrem Umfeld und zwar am allermeisten von ihren Partnerinnen, sofern sie welche haben. Warum das so ist, da kann man dann drüber reden, über das Geschlechterbild, wie man als Mann zu sein hat. Man kann über neoliberale Vereinzelungen reden, dass wir alle nur noch irgendwie arbeiten müssen und unser persönliches Vorankommen umsorgen müssen. Aber dass soziale Kontakte da einfach ein bisschen runterfallen. Man könnte darüber reden, dass heute nicht nur die ganze Arbeitssituation, sondern schon Ausbildung, die politischen Verhältnisse, die klimatischen Verhältnisse alle mega prekär sind. Jeder ist auf sich allein gestellt. Wir müssen gucken, dass wir irgendwie überleben. Und dann hat man dazu eben noch so eine männliche Prägung, die einen die Vereinzelung treibt. Das könnte man alles behandeln. Aber nein, das macht er eben nicht. Also wie gesagt, wenn wir über Mankeeping reden, dann reden wir nicht einfach nur über das, was Frauen ohnehin an emotionaler Arbeit mehr leisten, einfach weil sie Frauen sind und ihnen das so aufgebürdet wird, sondern es geht nochmal ganz spezifisch um den ökonomisch und gesellschaftlich bedingten Mehraufwand von Heterofrauen an Heteromännern in ihren Partnerschaften, weil eben diese Männer immer weniger intime Beziehungen führen. Und es hat exakt nichts mit Romantik, es hat nichts mit Liebe, es hat nichts mit Hingabe, es hat nichts mit Fürsorge einer tollen Hausfrau oder einer tollen Ehefrau zu tun, sondern eben mit der zunehmenden Vereinzelung der Männer. Und das nennt Ferrara Mankeeping. Also diesen spezifischen Mehraufwand. Deswegen ist es vielleicht auch nicht so gut, wenn dann in der New York Times oder in anderen Zeitungen so davon gesprochen wird, dass es beim Phänomen Mankeeping um eine mangelnde Gegenseitigkeit ginge. Das ist nämlich ja nicht der Punkt. Aber selbst, weil es geht ja nicht darum, dass jetzt Frauen und Männer gleichermaßen einsam sein sollen oder vereinzelt sein sollen, sich deswegen in ihren Partnerschaften gleichermaßen diese emotionale Arbeit angedeihen lassen sollen, sondern es geht ja darum, dass sie einfach wieder mehr Freundschaften führen können. So. Aber selbst im Untertitel von dem New York Times Artikel, den ja Matt Walsh auseinandernehmen möchte, heißt es: As male social circles shrink, female partners say they have to meet more social and emotional needs. Und das ist genau das, worum es geht. Wenn die sozialen Zirkel schrumpfen, dann müssen die weiblichen Partnerinnen eben für die emotionale Arbeit aufkommen. So. Und der Punkt ist ja, dass Walsh ja dieses Problem mit der männlichen Einsamkeit anerkennt, wenn er sagt:
In a 2021 survey, 15% of men said they didn't have any close friends, up from 3% in 1990. In 1990, nearly half of young men said they would reach out to friends when facing a personal issue. Three decades later, just over 20% said the same. Dr. Ferrara found that women tended to have all of these nodes of support they were going to for problems, whereas men were more likely to be going to just them.
Und wenn ich sowas anerkenne und solche Statistiken lese, dann wäre ich ja als Podcaster jetzt in der Situation, wo ich halt mehr über die Freundschaft sprechen würde oder eher über die Nicht-Freundschaft der Männer. Aber was er ja eigentlich nur im Sinn hat, ist, seine heilige Familie hochzuhalten. Denn es geht, der schwenkt komplett in der Diskussion nur auf Partnerschaften um und es geht einfach überhaupt nicht mehr um Männerfreundschaften oder die nicht existierenden Männerfreundschaften, sondern sein einziger Angriffspunkt, den er hat, sind die bösen Feministinnen, denn...
And the point is that, as you probably already suspected, man-keeping is yet another term feminists have coined as an elaborate and roundabout way of justifying their own monstrous, hideous narcissism. They are selfish. These are selfish women.
Also, nur, dass wir uns hier nicht falsch gehen, gell? Monstrous, hidden, selfish.
And they want to continue being selfish. And anything that distracts from them focusing 100% of their energies on themselves and their own desires is emotional labor. That's what they really mean by the term. And that's why, as usual, the struggles of men are being reframed as problems for women.
Und es ist halt so absurd, weil er möchte sich jetzt aufspielen als der die Sorgen der Männer ernst nimmt, aber das, was er gerade als Problem aufgeworfen hat, nämlich der Mangel an Freundschaften, wird von ihm keines einzigen Wortes mehr gewürdigt. Und das ist einfach so typisch. Es geht ihm nämlich auch nicht um die Männer. Also, dass es den Feministinnen nicht um die Männer geht, ich meine, das ist ja Feminismus, gell? Also, das ist ja auch schon irgendwo verständlich, dass man da irgendwie schaut, okay, es geht halt um eine patriarchal bedingte strukturelle Machtungleichheit. Natürlich guckt man da eher erstmal auf die es am meisten betrifft, nämlich die Frauen. Natürlich kann man auf die Männer schauen, aber wenn man das jetzt zum Ansatz macht, also gerade sagt, wir müssen jetzt auf die Männer schauen, ja, dann mach es doch. Aber er macht's ja gar nicht. Er guckt nämlich nicht auf die Männer, er guckt eigentlich nur auf das, was er durch die Feministinnen angegriffen hat. Aber wenn man ihn jetzt fragt, ja gut, wenn er schon jetzt nicht die Freundschaften oder die mangelnden Freundschaften von Männern adressiert, ja, was ist denn für ihn das Eigentliche, das nicht gesehen wird, das Leiden der Männer, wo sie mal ernst genommen werden müssten, was von den Feministinnen immer unsichtbar gemacht wird? Und da sagt er ganz deutlich:
I carry 100% of the burden to provide for the family and ensure that we always have a roof over our heads and food on our plates.
Ja, also da weiß ich jetzt auch nicht mehr, was ich zu sagen soll. Also klar, das Leid der Männer ist für ihn die Bürde der Arbeit. Gut. Ich verstehe trotzdem nicht, warum er sich jetzt so gegen dieses Mankeeping wehrt. Weil wir reden ja hier von strukturellen Problemen, die in die Beziehung eingreifen, die die Qualität der Beziehung vermindern. Und ich weiß nicht, er ist einfach unfähig oder einfach auch nur ungewillt, the bigger picture zu beachten und zu sehen, dass diese gesellschaftlichen Probleme zu emotionalen Konflikten in der Partnerschaft führen und dass man deswegen vielleicht auch politische Konsequenzen ziehen könnte. Aber nein, er will eigentlich überhaupt nicht irgendwas verändern. Und das wird deswegen noch absurder, weil er ja selber ganz glasklar zugibt, dass er im Sinne von Mankeeping gemancapped wird. Indem er, also wirklich, er sagt es ja, also und zwar so.
You know, I'll fully admit, if I ever find myself at a social event of any kind, it's almost always because my wife coordinated, planned it, scheduled it, and convinced me to attend. And reminded me like 20 times that we're doing this thing on Saturday.
Und wie gesagt, also ich meine, seine Konsequenz daraus oder sein Fazit oder warum das so ist, wie er sich das erklärt, ist ja, wie er schon in der Einleitung gesagt hat.
It means that my wife is my wife.
So, his wife is his wife. Punkt. Und dann sagt er noch, ja, also wenn er auf sich eingestellt würde und seine Frau nicht da wäre, dann würde er wie ein Eremit im Wald leben und bräuchte keine sozialen Kontakte. Und ich denke mir, ja, ist ja schön und gut, kannst ja machen. Aber wer bist du jetzt, dass du für alle Männer sprechen würdest? Ich meine, er schickt sich an, für die Männer zu sprechen, ignoriert aber das Problem, was dort formuliert wird, spricht dann nur von sich, wie er es machen würde. Und das ist dann seine Antwort auf eine feministische Kritik. Also, kann man machen, muss man sich aber auch erstmal trauen. Ich meine, die 100 Männer, die Angelica Ferrara für ihre Forschung interviewt hat, sprechen ja auch in großen Teilen von einer großen Sehnsucht nach mehr Intimität. Das heißt, die sagen nicht, ja, wir würden halt einfach einsam im Wald leben, sondern die sagen, ich krieg's nicht hin. Und irgendwie merke ich, da ist ein Loch in meinem Leben und ich krieg es nicht gefüllt. Und ich denke mir, da kann man ja mal mehr drüber reden, als nur zu sagen, wie er selber im Wald seine Würstchen grillen würde, ohne Friends, die er offensichtlich nicht braucht. Was natürlich bei ihm auch ein bisschen, man sich auch denkt, ja, keine Ahnung, wie das jetzt genau stattfinden soll. Ich meine, der Typ ist halt auch krass privilegiert, im Sinne von, er ist einfach ein weißer, heterosexueller, christlicher US-Amerikaner, der mit 3 Millionen Followern auf YouTube wahrscheinlich auch einfach unendlich viel Kohle macht und eine Diskurshoheit hat. Also, dass der sagen kann, ja, ich würde einfach alleine im Wald leben können, lässt sich in dieser Situation auch relativ einfach sagen, weil er mehr Sicherheit eigentlich nicht genießen könnte. Wenn wir jetzt darauf versuchen zu kommen, wie er diesen Unterschied nicht als Problem anerkennen möchte, dann versucht er auch eine Erklärung mitzugeben und die sieht so aus.
Now, am I saying that wives should step up and carry more of this weight in order to make things equal? No, I'm saying that nothing is equal in a healthy marriage. The husband and wife are different people and will carry different burdens to different degrees. They can either choose to whine and complain about this and make themselves into perpetually aggrieved martyrs, or they can delight in the opportunity to serve and love their family in a way that the other cannot.
Ja, hier sehen wir wieder die komplette Verwirrung von Mankeeping mit emotional care, mit Emotion Work, also im Sinne einer unbezahlten Sorgearbeit, das wird bei ihm alles irgendwie zusammengeworfen, ist auch gar nicht so wichtig, das zu differenzieren, weil Frauen leisten das einfach weil sie eben Frauen sind. Und das Argument, dass Frauen und Männer auch in Beziehungen unterschiedlich sein können, ist ja selbstverständlich. Aber er macht halt aus dem, sie dürfen unterschiedlich sein, ein, sie sollen unterschiedlich sein. Nur dann wäre die Partnerschaft healthy, also gesund, nur dann würde sie wirklich funktionieren. Und wieder, das hat erstens überhaupt nichts mit Mankeeping zu tun und zweitens ist es wieder seine persönliche Meinung. Er kann sich diese Last von Mankeeping nur als Problem einer Einstellung vorstellen, indem er dann am Ende von als Fazit von seinem Video sagt:
And any woman running around whining about mankeeping obviously has chosen to adopt the wrong attitude and the wrong perspective. You have chosen to make yourself the martyr.
Ja, und so wie die Feministinnen nach Ansicht von Matt Walsh entschieden haben, Märtyrerinnen zu sein, hat Matt Walsh sich entschieden, nicht über die wirklichen Probleme von Männern zu reden, die sie auch zum Beispiel in den Interviews mit den verhassten Feministinnen äußern, sondern er hat sich dafür entschieden, alles, und zwar ausschließlich alles, was von feministischer Kritik kommt, ausschließlich gegen seine christkonservative, hetero, Kleinfamilienideologie zu verteidigen. Und das verhindert ihn einfach zu sehen, worum es eigentlich geht, er rafft es einfach nicht, weil er so besessen davon ist, feministische Kritik abzuwehren, dass ja eigentlich viel Substanz nicht übrig bleibt. Wenn also Angelica Ferrara sagt, naja, also dieses Interview wollte sie sich nicht geben, weil ja, sie muss sich ein bisschen mentale Hygiene mäßig davon fernhalten, kann ich ihr nur beipflichten. Ich habe versucht, euch zu zeigen, warum dieses Video die Minuten nicht wert ist, in denen es gedreht worden ist. Deswegen, ja, wünsche ich euch ganz viel Spaß ist, nicht zu hören. Kurz vor dem Ende möchte ich noch ein paar Dinge ankündigen. Also erstens, wenn ihr diesen Podcast hier oder meine Arbeit im Allgemeinen auf Social Media, aber auch irgendwie mich als Autoren und mich als Podcaster unterstützen wollt, könnt ihr das sehr gerne tun, indem ihr mir auf Patreon, auf Steady ein Abo dalasst, schon ab 3 Euro, wenn ich mich recht entsinne. Ihr könnt mir auf PayPal was überweisen, ganz classy. Da würde ich mich sehr freuen. Oder auf Ko-Fi. Wenn ihr mich monatlich abonniert, habt ihr auch Zugriff auf Sonderfolgen. Momentan gibt es erst eine, weil der Podcast noch nicht so lange existiert oder auch diese Abo-Funktion nicht. Diese Sonderfolgen werden daraus bestehen, dass ich eure Fragen beantworte. Also wenn ihr Lust habt, dass ich mich zu Themen äußere, dann schreibt mir einfach entweder an fragole@olelibel.com oder einfach eine DM auf Insta oder TikTok und dann werde ich es entsprechend sammeln und aufnehmen. Zusätzlich zu dieser Sonderfolge, die ich in der nächsten Woche aufnehmen werde, kommen jetzt auch etwas dichter noch Folgen. Ich hatte im letzten Monat nicht wirklich was veröffentlichen können, weil ich einfach eine Deadline hatte mit meinem Buch. Das war einfach ein bisschen zu viel. Aber deswegen folgt jetzt in dichterer Folge nach dem Interview mit Angelica Ferrara noch eine Folge zu Performative Males, weil muss halt sein. Ich meine, ich mache feministischen Content und habe einen Schnurrbart. Außerdem würde ich noch ein Buch sehr ausführlich besprechen. Ich hatte das auf Insta schon mal angekündigt. Das ist nämlich Martin Schröder, ein deutscher Soziologe, der das Buch Wann sind Frauen wirklich zufrieden rausgebracht hat. Das ist 2023 schon erschienen. Ich habe es jetzt erst gelesen und es hat mich in vielerlei Hinsicht erschüttert, irritiert und erschreckt. Ich habe Martin Schröder für ein Interview angefragt, aber er hat noch nicht geantwortet. Wir werden sehen, ob das irgendwie geht. Er war auch im Urlaub und so. Ich hake da nochmal nach. Ansonsten würde ich das in Tiefe besprechen. Da sind einige Statistiken, die wir uns aus einer feministischen Perspektive wirklich anschauen sollten, die viel in Frage stellen, was wir für richtig, wahr und gut halten und warum das vielleicht stimmt oder auch nicht stimmt. Da werde ich auch nochmal genauer drauf eingehen. Bis dahin also wünsche ich euch einen schönen Tag, einen schönen Abend, einen schönen Morgen und bis bald. Ciao.